finally gotten around to what the froggies called the pièce de résistance. She started out the door and saw Alden's hat, the one with the fur-lined ear flaps, hanging on one of the pegs in the entry. She put it on, the bill came all the way down to her shaggy salt-and-pepper eyebrows, and then looked around one last time to see if she had forgotten anything. The stove was low, and Alden had left the drawer open too much again. She told him and told him, but that was one thing he was just never going to get straight. "Alden, you'll burn an extra quarter cord a winter when I'm gone," she muttered, and opened the stove. She looked in, and a tight, dismayed gasp escaped her. She slammed the door shut and adjusted the draw with trembling fingers. For a moment, just a moment, she had seen her old friend Annabel Frayne in the coals. It was her face to the life, even down to the mole on her cheek. And had Annabel winked at her? She thought of leaving Alden a note to explain where she had gone. But she thought perhaps Alden would understand in his own slow way. Still writing notes in her head. "Since the first day of winter, I have been seeing your father, and he says dying isn't so bad, at least I think that's it." Stella stepped out into the white day. The wind shook her, and she had to reset Alden's cap on her head before the wind could steal it for a joke and cartwheel it away. The cold seemed to find every chink in her clothing and twist into her, damp March cold, with wet snow on its mind. She set off down the hill toward the cove, being careful to walk on the cinders and clinkers that George Dinsmore had spread. Once George had gotten a job driving plow for the town of Raccoon Head, but during the big blow of 77, he had gotten smashed on rye whiskey and had driven the plow smack through not one, not two, but three power poles. There had been no lights over the head for 5 days. Stella remembered now how strange it had been, looking across the reach and seeing only blackness. The body got used to seeing that brave little nestle of lights. Now George worked on the island, and since there was no plow, he didn't get into much hurt. As she passed Russell Bowie's house, she saw Missy, pale as milk, looking out at her. Stella waved. Missy waved back. She would tell them this. "On the island we always watched out for our own. When Gerd Henried broke the blood vessel in his chest that time, we had covered dish suppers one whole summer to pay for his operation in Boston, and Gerd came back alive, thank God. When George Dinsmore ran down those power poles and the hydro slapped a lien on his home, it was seen, too, that the hydro had their money, and George had enough of a job to keep him in cigarettes and booze, why not? He was good for nothing else when his workday was done, although when he was on the clock he would work like a dray horse. That one time he got into trouble was because it was at night, and night was always George's drinking time. His father kept him fed, at least. Now Missy Bowie's alone with another baby. Maybe she'll stay here and take her welfare and ADC money here, and most likely it won't be enough. But she'll get the help she needs. Probably she'll go, but if she stays, she'll not starve. And listen, Lona and Hal, if she stays, she may be able to keep something of this small world with the little reach on one side and the big reach on the other. Something it would be too easy to lose hustling hash in Lewiston, or donuts in Portland, or drinks at the Nashville North in Bangor, and I am old enough not to beat around the bush about what that something might be. A way of being, and a way of living. A feeling." They had watched out for their own in other ways as well, but she would not tell them that. The children would not understand. Nor would Lois and David, although Jane had known the truth. There was Norman and Eddie Wilson's baby that was born a mongoloid, its poor dear little feet turned in, its bald skull lumpy and cratered, its fingers webbed together as if it had dreamed too long and too deep while swimming that interior reach. Reverend McCracken had come and baptized the baby, and a day later Mary Dodge came, who even at that time had midwifed over 100 babies. And Norman took Eddie down the hill to see Frank Child's new boat. and although she could barely walk, Eddie went with no complaint. Although she had stopped in the door to look back at Mary Dodge, who was sitting calmly by the idiot baby's crib and knitting. Mary had looked up at her, and when their eyes met, Eddie burst into tears. "Come on," Norman had said, upset. "Come on, Eddie, come on." And when they came back an hour later, the baby was dead. One of those crib deaths, wasn't it merciful? He didn't suffer. And many years before that, before the war, during the Depression, three little girls had been molested coming home from school, not badly molested, at least not where you could see the scar of the hurt, and they all told about a man who offered to show them a deck of cards he had with a different kind of dog on each one. He would show them this wonderful deck of cards, the man said, if the little girls would come into the bushes with him. And once in the bushes, this man said, "But you have to touch this first." One of the little girls was Gert Symes, who would go on to be voted Maine's Teacher of the Year in 1978 for her work at Brunswick High. And Gert, then only 5 years old, told her father that the man had some fingers gone on one hand. One of the other little girls agreed that this was so. The third remembered nothing. Stella remembered Alden going out one thundery day that summer without telling her where he was going, although she asked. Watching from the window, she had seen Alden meet Bull Symes at the bottom of the path, and then Freddie Dinsmore joined them, and down at the coast she saw her own husband, whom she had sent out that morning just as usual with his dinner pail under his arm. More men joined them, and when they finally moved off she counted just one under a dozen. The Reverend McCracken's predecessor had been among them. And that evening a fellow named Daniels was found at the foot of Slider's Point, where the rocks poke out of the surf like the fangs of a dragon that drowned with its mouth open. This Daniels was a fellow Big George Havelock had hired to help him put new sills under his house, and a new engine in his Model A truck. From New Hampshire he was, and he was a sweet talker who had found other odd jobs to do when the work at the Havelocks was done. And in church, he could carry a tune. Apparently, they said, Daniels had been walking up on top of Slider's Point and had slipped, tumbling all the way to the bottom. His neck was broken and his head was bashed in. As he had no people that anyone knew of, he was buried on the island, and the Reverend McCracken's predecessor gave the graveyard eulogy, saying as how this Daniels had been a hard worker and a good help, even though he was two fingers shy on his right hand. Then he read the benediction, and the graveside group had gone back to the town hall basement, where they drank Zarek's punch and ate cream cheese sandwiches. And Stella never asked her men where they had gone on the day Daniels fell from the top of Slider's Point. "Children," she would tell them, "we always watched out for our own. We had to, for the reach was wider in those days. And when the wind roared and the surf pounded and the dark came early, why, we felt very small, no more than dust motes in the mind of God. So it was natural for us to join hands one with the other. We join hands, children, and if there were times when we wondered what it was all for, or if there was airy such a thing as love at all, it was only because we had heard the wind and the waters on long winter nights and we were afraid. No, I've never felt I needed to leave the island. My life was here. The reach was wider in those days." Stella reached the cove. She looked right and left, the wind blowing her dress out behind her like a flag. If anyone had been there, she would have walked further down and taken her chance on the tumbled rocks, although they were glazed with ice. But no one was there, and she walked out along the pier, past the old Symes boathouse. She reached the end and stood there for a moment, head held up, the wind blowing past the padded flaps of Alden's hat in a muffled flood. Bill was out there, beckoning. Beyond him, beyond the reach, she could see the Congo church over there on the head, its spire almost invisible against the white sky. Grunting, she sat down on the end of the pier, and then stepped onto the snow crust below. Her boots sank a little, not much. She set Alden's cap again, how the wind wanted to tear it off, and began to walk towards Bill. She thought once that she would look back. But she did not. She didn't believe her heart could stand that. She walked, her boots crunching into the crust, and listened to the faint thud and give of the ice. There was Bill, further back now, but still beckoning. She coughed, spat blood onto the white snow that covered the ice. Now the reach spread wide on either side, and she could, for the first time in her life, read the Stanton's Bait and Boat sign over there without Alden's binoculars. She could see the cars passing to and fro on the head's main street, and thought with real wonder, they can go as far as they want. Portland, Boston, New York City, imagine. And she could almost do it, could almost imagine a road that simply rolled on and on, the boundaries of the world knocked wide. A snowflake skirled past her eyes. Another, a third. Soon it was snowing lightly, and she walked through a pleasant world of shifting bright white. She saw a raccoon head through a gauzy curtain that sometimes almost cleared. She reached up to set Alden's cap again, and snow puffed off the bill into her eyes. The wind twisted fresh snow up in filmy shapes, and in one of them she saw Carl Abersham, who had gone down with Hattie Stoddard's husband on the Dancer. Soon, however, the brightness began to dull as the snow came harder. The head's main street dimmed, dimmed, and at last was gone. For a time longer she could make out the cross atop the church, and then that faded out too like a false dream. Last to go was that bright yellow and black sign reading Stanton's Bait and Boat, where you could also get engine oil, flypaper, Italian sandwiches, and Budweiser to go. Then Stella walked in a world that was totally without color, a gray-white dream of snow. Just like Jesus out of the boat, she thought. And at last she looked back. But now the island was gone, too. She could see her tracks going back, losing definition, until only the faint half-circles of her heels could be seen, and then nothing, nothing at all. She thought, it's a whiteout. You gotta be careful, Stella, or you'll never get to the mainland. You'll just walk around in a big circle until you're worn out, and then you'll freeze to death out here. She remembered Bill telling her once that when you were lost in the woods, you had to pretend that the leg which was on the same side of your body as your smart hand was lame. Otherwise, that smart leg would begin to lead you, and you'd walk in a circle and not even realize it until you came around to your back trail again. Stella didn't believe she could afford to have that happen to her. Snow today, tonight, and tomorrow, the radio had said. And in a whiteout such as this, she would not even know if she came around to her back trail, for the wind and the fresh snow would erase it long before she could return to it. Her hands were leaving her, in spite of the two pairs of gloves she wore, and her feet had been gone for some time. In a way, this was almost a relief. The numbness at least shut the mouth of her clamoring arthritis. Stella began to limp now, making her left leg work harder. The arthritis in her knees had not gone to sleep, and soon they were screaming at her. Her white hair flew out behind her. Her lips had drawn back from her teeth. She still had her own, all save four. And she looked straight ahead, waiting for that yellow and black sign to materialize out of the flying whiteness. It did not happen. Sometime later she noticed that the day's bright whiteness had begun to dull to a more uniform gray. The snow fell heavier and thicker than ever. Her feet were still planted on the crust, but now she was walking through 5 inches of fresh snow. She looked at her watch, but it had stopped. Stella realized she must have forgotten to wind it that morning, for the first time in 20 or 30 years. Or had it just stopped for good? It had been her mother's, and she had sent it with Alden twice to the head, where Mr. Dosti had first marveled over it, and then cleaned it. Her watch, at least, had been to the mainland. She fell down for the first time some 15 minutes after she began to notice the day's growing grayness. For a moment she remained on her hands and knees, thinking it would be so easy just to stay here, to curl up and listen to the wind. And then the determination that had brought her through so much reasserted itself, and she got up grimacing. She stood in the wind, looking straight ahead, willing her eyes to see, but they saw nothing. Be dark soon. Well, she had gone wrong. She had slipped off to one side or the other. Otherwise she would have reached the mainland by now. Yet she didn't believe she had gone so far wrong that she was walking parallel to the mainland, or even back in the direction of Goat. An interior navigator in her head whispered that she had overcompensated and slipped off to the left. She believed she was still approaching the mainland, but was now on a costly diagonal. That navigator wanted her to turn right, but she would not do that. Instead, she moved straight on again, but stopped the artificial limp. A spasm of coughing shook her, and she spat bright red into the snow. 10 minutes later, the gray was now deep indeed, and she found herself in the weird twilight of a heavy snowstorm. She fell again, tried to get up, failed at first, and finally managed to gain her feet. She stood swaying in the snow, barely able to remain upright in the wind, waves of faintness rushing through her head, making her feel alternately heavy and light. Perhaps not all the roaring she heard in her ears was the wind, but it surely was the wind that finally succeeded in prying Alden's hat from her head. She made a grab for it, but the wind danced it easily out of her reach, and she saw it only for a moment, flipping gaily over and over into the darkening gray, a bright spot of orange. It struck the snow, rolled, rose again, was gone. Now her hair flew around her head freely. "It's all right, Stella," Bill said. "You can wear mine." She gasped and looked around in the white. Her gloved hands had gone instinctively to her bosom, and she felt sharp fingernails scratch at her heart. She saw nothing but shifting membranes of snow. And then, moving out of that evening's gray throat, the wind screaming through it like the voice of a devil in a snowy tunnel, came her husband. He was at first only moving colors in the snow, red, black, dark green, lighter green. Then these colors resolved themselves into a flannel jacket with a flapping collar, flannel pants, and green boots. He was holding his hat out to her in a gesture that appeared almost absurdly courtly, and his face was Bill's face, unmarked by the cancer that had taken him. Had that been all she was afraid of? That a wasted shadow of her husband would come to her, a scrawny concentration camp figure with a skin pulled taut and shiny over the cheekbones, and the eyes sunken deep in the sockets? And she felt a surge of relief. "Bill, is that really you?" "Of course." "Bill," she said again, and took a glad step toward him. Her legs betrayed her, and she thought she would fall. Fall right through him. He was, after all, a ghost. But he caught her in arms as strong and as competent as those that had carried her over the threshold of the house that she had shared only with Alden in these latter years. He supported her, and a moment later she felt the cap pulled firmly onto her head. "Is it really you?" she asked again. Looking up into his face, at the crow's feet around his eyes, which hadn't sunk deep yet, at the spill of snow on the shoulders of his checked hunting jacket, at his lively brown hair. "It's me," he said. "It's all of us." He half turned with her, and she saw the others, coming out of the snow that the wind drove across the reach in the gathering darkness. A cry, half joy, half fear, came from her mouth as she saw Madeline Stoddard, Hattie's mother, in a blue dress that swung in the wind like a bell. And holding her hand was Hattie's dad. Not a moldering skeleton somewhere on the bottom with the dancer, but whole and young. And there, behind those two, "Annabelle," she cried. "Annabelle Frayne, is it you?" It was Annabelle. Even in this snowy gloom, Stella recognized the yellow dress Annabelle had worn to Stella's own wedding. And as she struggled toward her dead friend, holding Bill's arm, she thought that she could smell roses. "Annabelle." "We're almost there now, dear," Annabelle said, taking her other arm. The yellow dress, which had been considered daring in its day, but to Annabelle's credit and to everyone else's relief, not quite a scandal, left her shoulders bare, but Annabelle did not seem to feel the cold. Her hair, a soft, dark auburn, blew long in the wind. Only a little further. She took Stella's other arm and they moved forward again. Other figures came out of the snowy night, for it was night now. Stella recognized many of them, but not all. Tommy Frayne had joined Annabelle. Big George Havelock, who had died a dog's death in the woods, walked behind Bill. There was the fellow who had kept the lighthouse on the head for most of 20 years, and who used to come over to the island during the cribbage tournament Freddie Dinsmore held every February. Stella could almost but not quite remember his name. And there was Freddie himself. Walking off to one side of Freddie, by himself and looking bewildered, was Russell Bowie. "Look, Stella," Bill said. And she saw black rising out of the gloom, like the splintered prows of many ships. It was not ships. It was split and fissured rock. They had reached the head. They had crossed the reach. She heard voices, but was not sure they actually spoke. "Take my hand, Stella." "Do you?" "Take my hand, Bill."
"Oh, do you? Do you?"
"Annabelle. Freddie. Russell. John. Eddie. Frank. Take my hand, take my hand, my hand."
"Do you love?"
"Will you take my hand, Stella?" a new voice asked. She looked around, and there was Bull Symes. He was smiling kindly at her, and yet she felt a kind of terror in her at what was in his eyes, and for a moment she drew away, clutching Bill's hand on her other side the tighter.
"Is it time?" Bull asked. "Oh, Stella, I guess so. But it don't hurt. At least, I never heard so. All that's before." She burst into tears suddenly, all the tears she had never wept, and put her hand in Bull's hand. "Yes," she said. "Yes, I will. Yes, I did. Yes, I do."
They stood in a circle in the storm, the dead of Goat Island, and the wind screamed around them, driving its packet of snow, and some kind of song burst from her. It went up into the wind, and the wind carried it away. They all sang then, as children will sing in their high sweet voices as a summer evening draws down to summer night. They sang, and Stella felt herself going to them and with them, finally across the reach. There was a bit of pain, but not much. Losing her maidenhead had been worse. They stood in a circle in the night. The snow blew around them, and they sang. They sang, and Alden could not tell David and Lois, but in the summer, after Stella died, when the children came out for their annual 2 weeks, he told Lona and Hal. He told them that during the great storms of winter, the wind seems to sing with almost human voices, and that sometimes it seemed to him he could almost make out the words, Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise him, ye creatures here below. But he did not tell them. Imagine slow, unimaginative Alden Flanders saying such things aloud, even to the children, that sometimes he would hear that sound and feel cold even by the stove, that he would put his whittling aside or the trap he had meant to mend, thinking that the wind sang in all the voices of those who were dead and gone, that they stood somewhere out on the reach and sang as children do. He seemed to hear their voices, and on these nights he sometimes slept and dreamed that he was singing the doxology, unseen and unheard, at his own funeral. There are things that can never be told, and there are things not exactly secret that are not discussed. They had found Stella frozen to death on the mainland a day after the storm had blown itself out. She was sitting on a natural chair of rock about 100 yards south of the Raccoon Head town limits, frozen just as neat as you please. The doctor who owned the Corvette said that he was frankly amazed. It would have been a walk of over 4 miles, and the autopsy required by law in the case of an unattended unusual death had shown an advanced cancerous condition. In truth, the old woman had been riddled with it. Was Alden to tell David and Lois that the cap on her head had not been his? Larry McKean had recognized that cap. So had John Benson. He had seen it in their eyes, and he supposed they had seen it in his. He had not lived long enough to forget his dead father's cap, the look of its bill, or the places where the visor had been broken. These are things made for thinking on slowly. He would have told the children if he had known how. Things to be thought on at length, while the hands do their work and the coffee sits in a solid china mug nearby. They are questions of reach, maybe. Do the dead sing? And do they love the living? On the nights after Lona and Hal had gone back with their parents to the mainland in Al Curry's boat, the children standing astern and waving goodbye, Alden considered that question, and others, and the matter of his father's cap. Do the dead sing? Do they love? On those long nights alone, with his mother Stella Flanders at long last in her grave, it often seemed to Alden that they did both.
Skeleton Crew was written by Stephen King and read by Stephen King, Dylan Baker, Kyle Beltran, Matthew Broderick, Norbert Leo Butz, Paul Giamatti, Michael C. Hall, Dana Ivey, David Morse, Will Patton, Robert Petkoff, Lois Smith, Francis Sternhagen. It was recorded by Terry Hogan, Mike Ticino, Noriko Okabe, Julian Dreyer, Matt Stilo, Nathan Lincoln, and Sean Jackson. Editing and post-production by Mike Ticino for Common Mode. The associate producers were Tiffany Frari and Michael Noble. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. Grandma, the Monkey, Mrs. Todd's Shortcut, and The Raft were produced by Penguin High Bridge Audio, recorded in 1987. All other stories in Skeleton Crew were produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.